Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jamal Abdi, Policy Director with the National Iranian American Council, who talks about the dangerous rise in tensions between the U.S. and Iran just 6 weeks before the U.S. presidential election. Ben Beachy of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who describes the many concerns labor, consumer, and environmental groups have with ongoing secret negotiations over the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. Andrew Kukurowski, Research Associate with the Prison Policy Initiative, who explains why his group has launched a campaign to pressure the FCC to roll back the exorbitant expense of prison phone calls. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the run-up to a dialogue about global water security at the United Nations General Assembly meeting in New York, a coalition of high-level former government officials, the Interaction Council, has issued a set of policy recommendations. The group is urging global action on water conservation, major investment in water and sanitation systems in poor nations, and a new strategy to deal with the growing number of environmental refugees. Former Canadian Prime Minister Jean Chrétien, speaking for the new coalition, declared, "The future impact of water scarcity may be devastating. Using water the same way as we have done in the past simply will not sustain humanity in the future." Former Norwegian Prime Minister Gro Harlem Brundtland pointed to current water hotspots in sub-Saharan Africa and West Asia as fertile ground for future water wars. The rising global appetite for food will require an additional trillion, that's a million cubic feet of water a year, equal to the water flow of 100 Colorado rivers. Emerging economies, such as China and India, will likely exceed their nation's existing water supplies within 20 years. The San Onofre nuclear power plant in Southern California shut down on January the 31st after a critical tube in Unit 3 sprang a leak and radioactive steam was released into the community. San Onofre's two reactors have remained shut down for safety concerns ever since. The reactor's operator, Southern California Edison, which recently laid off 730 workers at the plant, plans to reopen Unit 2 in October, but Unit 3, badly damaged in the incident, will remain closed indefinitely. After a three-month investigation, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission blamed the plant's management for lapses in safety. The NRC investigation found unusual wear on 300 of Unit 3's cooling tubes, caused by excessive vibration. The report focused on a flawed computer model used by the generator's manufacturer, Mitsubishi Heavy Industries. As the cost of the closed reactors adds up, opposition to reopening the nuclear plant is growing. The Laguna Beach City Council recently passed a resolution calling for the San Onofre complex to remain closed until an amended licensing hearing with full public review takes place. Harper Reed doesn't have the typical resume of your average political power broker. The 35-year-old hipster, who wears an earring, is the chief technology guru for the Obama re-election campaign. He listens to death metal and never worked on a political campaign before. Reed first became known as a Chicago hacker and later as the manager of the online community for t-shirt maker Threadless. Working for Obama, Reed designed the campaign website's dashboard portal, which offers new ways of online engagement, such as offering online petitions. For return visitors, the portal provides activists the opportunity to state what the election campaign means to them. Key information, such as support for gay rights, is carefully tracked. According to Mother Jones magazine, the 2008 Obama campaign took election data analysis to a new level with the help of Facebook co-founder Chris Hughes, the current owner of the New Republic magazine. 4 years ago, Obama's website raised large amounts of money and successfully recruited tens of thousands of volunteers. The campaign also figured out how to get around privacy restrictions on social media by having activists sign up for their My.BarackObama account using Facebook. Professor David Kreis of the University of North Carolina described the large amounts of personal data gathered on individuals by political campaigns as creepy. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
Thank you.
With the U.S. presidential election just 6 weeks away, tensions between America, Israel, and Iran, reflected in increasingly bellicose rhetoric, has escalated in recent days. In his speech before the U.N. General Assembly on September 25th, President Obama warned Iran that time was running out to find a negotiated way out of the long-running impasse over the West's charge that Tehran is covertly working to acquire the technology to build nuclear weapons. Iran has long maintained that their uranium enrichment program is designed solely for civilian energy purposes. Meanwhile, U.S. warships led joint naval exercises in the Persian Gulf, reflecting concern about Iran's threat to block the flow of oil from the region if Israel or the U.S. should launch attacks against its nuclear research facilities. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu added to tension in the region when in recent weeks he publicly demanded that Mr. Obama make clear where his administration would draw a red line on Iran's nuclear program that would trigger a U.S. military response. All this comes as Iran continues to charge that the U.S., Israel, and Britain are responsible for the assassination of 5 Iranian nuclear scientists and researchers over the last several years and cyber attacks and sabotage targeting Iran's uranium enrichment facilities. More recently, the U.S. State Department's decision to remove the Iranian exile group MEK from its list of foreign terrorist organizations will surely be seen as another provocation by Tehran. Your reporter spoke with Jamal Abdi, policy director with the National Iranian American Council. He talks about the dangerous rise in tensions between Washington and Iran just weeks before the U.S. presidential election.
My biggest concern right now is not necessarily any one of these, policies or tactics that are being carried out, but rather it's the totality of the trajectory and that we have ratcheted things up so far that we're not actually going to be able to climb back. What we found, really the core of the policy right now is one based on sanctions. It's sanctions in the center, sabotage on the side in order to delay Iran's nuclear program, and then some limited talks that we get to have every year or so that don't necessarily yield anything immediately, and so they're pretty quickly abandoned. And we had the latest round of talks just a few months ago. We had several rounds. We had one in Baghdad, and then Moscow, and then Istanbul. And really what is most disconcerting about this, those talks, is that the Iranians actually came to the table with a deal. They actually put forward a willingness to comply with some of the demands the U.S. and the EU and the rest of the P5 plus one states had put on the table. The U.S. came to the table with 3 demands, and what they said was, we're offering sort of a menu of options for what they wanted the Iranians to do. And the Iranians came back and said they actually would end their 20% enrichment, which is the most provocative element of their program. That, sort of the issue that is 6 inches from our face, the fact that they're enriching at this higher level. But in exchange, the Iranians wanted the U.S. to do something about the sanctions, not lift all the sanctions, but actually refrain from imposing sanctions that were just about to go online regarding the Central Bank of Iran. And instead of actually being willing to make that trade or have a quid pro quo in which, in exchange for the Iranians making concessions, we make concessions, we basically said no. We're not willing to ease the sanctions in any way in order for an Iranian concession. And that is really problematic, because if these sanctions are in place permanently, if they're not something that we can actually trade in exchange for Iranian concessions, then they're not leverage. They're stuck in place. And I think that's the problem with all these policies.
Jamal, do you fear that the United States could be drawn into a war by unilateral action by Israel? The rhetoric seems to be going in that direction, but it may just be rhetoric. It could just be a bluff trying to move the Obama administration into taking a more harsh stand against Iran. What are your thoughts about that?
I tend to agree that this is actually a bluff intended to produce a policy in Washington and in Europe and among the other, Russia and China, a policy that is more hawkish towards Iran, a policy that undermines any sort of real diplomacy. And I don't think that Israel would be stupid enough to strike on their own. If they did, it's my sense that Iran would probably not be stupid enough to actually retaliate against the United States, although according to several simulations that have been done, you know, war games that have been done, the Pentagon has found that in the event of a strike, the Iranians eventually either retaliate against the U.S. or take some sort of escalatory measure that they judge as not being a direct threat to the U.S. But because there's no communications, there's a problem of the two sides misjudging the reaction, and you end up in this spiraling conflict that becomes an all-out war. But, you know, if the Iranians were actually struck, I think that the first thing that happens is they have a pretext to leave the nonproliferation treaty, to eject IAEA inspectors, to actually go forward with a rapid breakout to try to build a nuclear weapon even potentially. They would probably go to the UN and have a lot of political support to undo some of the multilateral sanctions. They may even successfully undo the international coalition and, you know, coalition of the willing in terms of unilateral sanctions. And really, what you then have, you know, at best is an Iran that is even closer to having a nuclear weapon, or at worst, an Iran that is at war with the United States and, you know, a war that encompasses the entire region and just a total catastrophe. But I don't see any good options coming out of an Israeli strike, and I tend to think that the Israelis understand this.
Jamal, it seems U.S. public opinion is decisively against, you know, initiating a new war somewhere else in the world after we've been embroiled since 2001 in constant warfare in Afghanistan and Iraq, and then in many other nations in the Middle East and North Africa, where we're engaged in the war against terrorism. What should citizens be saying at this point, given that there's concern about what capability Iran might have in the future to acquire a nuclear weapon, but at the same time wanting at all costs to avoid another 10-year-long war?
Holding members of Congress and members of the Senate accountable when they do something that is clearly a, you know, cynical attempt to appease the pro-war lobby, you know, whether it's sanctions or like this thing that happened just on Friday, the Senate voted to actually adopt a red line. The red line for war that mirrors the red line that Netanyahu has taken to the American television stations in order to promote, which has been at the center of this spat between Netanyahu and the Obama administration. So when the Senate does something like that, you know, for constituents to voice their concern and say, look, this isn't helping anything, you know, you're the ones that are actually slowly dragging us into this potential military conflict. After the election, there's going to be a real need to get whoever wins the White House to actually pursue a policy towards a diplomatic solution and really reinvigorate this diplomatic track and be willing to make some of the concessions that are required in negotiation. And I think voters and constituents and, you know, Americans will have a big role to play in pushing that.
That was Jamal Abdi, Policy Director with the National Iranian American Council. Find more news and analysis on the danger of a new U.S. war against Iran on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Unlike NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was the subject of heated political debate in the U.S. during the 1990s, a new free trade treaty, known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, has escaped most public attention and controversy. The proposed free trade treaty, the largest in U.S. history, includes the nations of Australia, Brunei, Chile, Malaysia, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, the U.S., and Vietnam. Japan, China, Mexico, and Canada are expected to join the talks later. Although ongoing negotiations have been kept secret, leaked documents reveal that the U.S. Trade Representative Ron Kirk is pushing countries involved in negotiations to give pharmaceutical companies new patent and monopoly rights that could limit the public's access to affordable medicines such as retroviral drugs to treat HIV and AIDS. Other concerns center around the treaty's expansion of corporate power to challenge national laws on worker rights, environmental regulations, and consumer protections. Despite the fact that TPP negotiations have been held under conditions of unprecedented secrecy, some 600 corporate advisors have access to details of the talks, including draft text of the treaty's language, while the public, members of Congress, journalists, and civil society are excluded. During the most recent round of treaty negotiations in Leesburg, Virginia, protesters from labor, consumer, and environmental groups engaged in peaceful protest and direct action to focus public attention on their demand for more transparency in the negotiations. While U.S. officials have pledged to hold a public comment period and congressional review after Trans-Pacific Partnership talks are complete, Critics maintain this isn't enough to provide civil society any meaningful input into the final language of the treaty. Your reporter spoke with Ben Beachy, research director with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who describes the many concerns activist groups have with ongoing negotiations over the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement.
Most people will be familiar with NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, an agreement widely repudiated and rejected by the populaces of the majority of the populaces of all of North America, of Mexico, Canada, and the United States, as proven again just this summer in polls. This is NAFTA on steroids. This is NAFTA plus. It's the largest NAFTA expansion we've seen. It would be the United States' largest so-called trade agreement, and could also possibly be the last one the U.S. ever negotiates, because it's been framed as a docking agreement, which means that any other country hereafter could join into this agreement. And Ron Kirk, our trade representative, has said, in fact, he would love nothing more than to see China join. And so this could very well be the last big blueprint for what trade policy is going to look like from here on out. And thus far, it looks like a repetition of NAFTA's failures.
Tell our listeners a bit about what are the major concerns that your organization, labor groups, consumer groups, and environmental activists have with this free trade agreement that's being negotiated.
Certainly. So this is when people think about free trade agreements, they think about like trading goods, anything from like corn to auto parts. That certainly is part of this. That's part of every trade agreement. But principally, these trade agreements aren't actually trade agreements. They're not about trading goods. NAFTA wasn't, and nor is the Trans-Pacific Partnership its cousin. The Trans-Pacific Partnership has 29 chapters in it. As far as we can tell, only three of those chapters actually talk about trading goods. So if this is really about trade, why write the other 26 chapters? Those other 26 chapters are very concerning to us because they are essentially a rewriting of public policy that's in the interest of consumers, rewriting it so it'd be in the interest of corporations. And it's largely the corporations who are doing the rewriting. There's 600 representatives who are in the official trade advisory system of the United States, and the vast majority of them, about 85% of them, represent the largest corporations in the U.S., Walmart, Halliburton, Dow Chemical. They're all in there. The single most represented entity in our trade advisory system is General Electric, which is notorious pioneer. Actually, it bragged about how it was a pioneer for outsourcing. And so for us, this is really an agreement against public interest written by corporations, and we are relying entirely on leaked chapters within this agreement because the text has not been revealed to the public. These same 600 corporate representatives I mentioned, meanwhile, have online access through a secure site anytime they'd like to the text. Even our Congress members don't have that. The access has been much more limited by the United States Trade Representative, and representatives from both parties have complained loudly that this has been unprecedented suppression of the text from Congress, not allowing them to have oversight, which, as our elected representatives, they should, much less the U.S. public, which has no access to the text other than through a leaked version that we've seen.
Well, Ben, if you had to put it in a nutshell, how would you frame the whole issue, maybe in comparison to NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement that everybody knew about and was a big discussion topic during the presidential election back in the 90s? How would you frame this in terms of what's of concern to the average person?
Yeah, well, I mean, the average person right now is concerned with jobs. And with NAFTA, we saw the decimation of at least a million manufacturing jobs. Actually, since the time that NAFTA was passed, one out of every four manufacturing jobs in the U.S. has disappeared, has been eroded, as factories have found it easier and easier to go overseas and set up shop there. It really facilitates offshoring. The erosion of our manufacturing base, even for those who haven't really felt it directly, those who have not been kicked out of a factory, it's really put downward pressure on wages. It's made it harder for unions to negotiate, and it's cited even by the Federal Reserve as one of the principal reasons we see increasing worker productivity in the United States, and yet a decreasing share of income going to workers. Most of it, increasing amounts are going to Wall Street capital. And so this divide between the workers and capital is increasing. Joblessness, especially in manufacturing, has continued at high levels, and this replication of this deal, another NAFTA, with half the Pacific, that actually it's an open-ended trade deal in which China could even join, really just threatens to just perpetuate this. The question is, when will it end? Have we not learned our lesson? Obama in 2008, as a candidate, really campaigned hard against NAFTA for this very reason. He went to the Rust Belt and said, we know why the Rust Belt turned rusty. We need a new trade agenda, one that actually prioritizes job growth rather than just continual race to the bottom job erosion. That's not what we see. We see a perpetuation of the same. The few chapters we have access to in the text of the TPP are a copy and paste, largely, of the NAFTA text. And so if you are against NAFTA and you don't think that the erosion of one out of every four manufacturing jobs is a good thing for the country, you've got all the reason in the world to be against the TPP.
That was Ben Beachy, Research Director with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Find links to more information on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Treaty on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. For the 2.2 million inmates in the U.S. prison system, phone calls to and from their loved ones are an important source of support and a way to help inmates transition back to society upon release. But in most states, the cost of these phone calls can be prohibitive, up to $1 a minute. That leaves most prisoners and their families with much less personal contact via phone calls than they would like. In some extreme cases, families have to choose between calling family members in prison and putting food on the table. Now a campaign is underway to pressure the Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, to make a ruling that interstate calls between prisoners and their families must be regulated to be priced at a reasonable rate. However, the ruling, if issued, would not affect calls between prisoners and their family members within the same state. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Drew Kukurowski, a research associate at the Prison Policy Initiative, a group that's active on examining the societal impact of mass incarceration. He explains how the prison phone system works, why it's so expensive, and the goal of the organization's current campaign targeting the FCC.
The way the prison telephone system works is that state departments of corrections, those are the state prison systems, enter into these exclusive contracts with the prison telephone company. For the vast majority of states, the prison telephone companies will pay a commission, which is a fancy name for a kickback, to the state Department of Correction. And what this does is that it drives the rates up because the company has to then bring in enough revenue to send some of that revenue back to the state Department of Correction. And so this practice has been banned in New York, and consequently, the rates have plummeted in New York now for the state prison system there. It's about 5 cents a minute for inmates to call their families in New York, which is a very reasonable rate. And notably, the company that has the contract for the New York prison system is Global Tellink, which is the sort of behemoth prison telephone company that has contracts in many of the other states that charges, exorbitant rates.
It seems rather obvious, but what's the impact of these high phone rates on the inmates and their families?
So one thing that the high rates do is that it reduces the frequency with which people in prison can speak with their families. For example, I track some of the letters that come in from people in prison to the FCC encouraging them to regulate the interstate long-distance rates. And if you read some of these letters that people in prison are writing in, you can see that they're saying things like, I would like to be able to talk to my brother or my parents, but I can only afford one 15-minute phone call a week with, my wife or my kid. And so what happens is, when the rates are for a 15-minute phone call are, $10 or $15 for a 15-minute phone call, it just commonsensically reduces the frequency that people are able to talk to their family members.
And that's because, I guess, most people in prison tend to be from low-income families. If you're a millionaire, I guess it doesn't really matter.
Right, exactly. If you're Bernie Madoff and you're in the federal BOP, it's not a problem. Your only limit is going to be, you can only talk on the phone so much when you're incarcerated. They won't let you talk unlimitedly. But for most people that come from low-income backgrounds, it can add up very quickly. one of the things the prison phone companies argue is that, and the state prison systems do too, is that with what they call debit-based or prepaid systems, that the prisoners themselves pay for the phone calls now rather than calling collect. But in most places, people that are incarcerated earn 20 or 30 cents an hour, and the way that their accounts get built up with money is through their family members putting money into their commissary account or their canteen account. So in almost all situations, it's really the families of the people that are incarcerated that end up footing the bill.
So, Drew Kukurowski, what's the role of the FCC, and what's your organization trying to get the FCC to do?
The FCC, as a federal agency, only has jurisdiction to regulate out-of-state long-distance prices. It cannot regulate long-distance or local calls that are within a single state. This is, sort of, a federal versus states' rights issue. But the FCC, still has the power to regulate interstate long-distance calls. And what they've been trying to do for about 10 years now, there was a lawsuit initially that was dismissed from court and sent over to the FCC for the Federal Communications Commission to propose a rulemaking to regulate the out-of-state, interstate, long-distance prices for the prison system. And what we're trying to do is there's a movement to really push the FCC to propose a rulemaking, publish it in the Federal Register, and once they propose that rulemaking, a year clock starts ticking for public comments, and hopefully at the end of that year, the FCC will enact a regulation that would impose a price cap on the rates that the prison telephone companies are allowed to charge for out-of-state long distance.
Is this something the general public can have an impact on? And if so, what can they do?
Yes, it is something that the general public can have an impact on. And they can put pressure on the FCC and let the FCC know that this is an issue that people care about and think that, it's important not just for the people that are incarcerated and for their families, but for the public at large, because this sort of social science studies are conclusive in that when people who are incarcerated have close family ties and family contact during their period of incarceration, they're less likely to commit another offense when they're released from prison. It's sort of a common sense point, but it gets backed up by the social science research too.
That was Drew Kukurowski of the Prison Policy Initiative. To learn more about the group's campaign for prison phone justice, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org. You can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Gates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.